So, retrospectors, what historical events are we ticking off on this week's run of Today in History?
Well, Tuesday is the anniversary of the first Tarzan movie to hit the silver screen.
Then on Wednesday, we tell the story of how Gottlieb Daimler inadvertently invented the motorbike.
On Thursday, we explain how MSG got demonized in the 1960s.
And on Friday, we revisit a legendary battle on a frozen Russian lake.
We discuss this and more on Today in History with the retrospectors. 10 minutes each weekday, wherever you get your podcasts.
When it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com. The number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello and welcome to the Media Podcast. I'm Ollie Mann, and here's a little bonus episode that we've put together just for you. It's one of our favourite sessions from the Edinburgh TV Festival, featuring the writer Sally Wainwright in conversation with Russell T Davies. Both writers worked on Coronation Street, but then of course moved on to write their own dramas. Sally most recently penning BBC One's Happy Valley and Last Tango in Halifax, and Russell creating Queer as Folk for Channel 4. And of course reviving Doctor Who in the early noughties. Thanks to the Edinburgh International Television Festival for sharing this recording with us, and to our sponsor, the Media Masters podcast. You'll find out who's on their show this week later in the programme. But first, a real treat. This is Sally Wainwright talking to Russell T Davies.
Now, Sally and I went out to discuss this evening and what would be discussed. How did that end, Sally?
Pissed.
What's she saying? She was sick in her bed. It was... Come on, it's all going to come out tonight. Yeah. So listen, hello. We've known each other for about 25 years, I think.
Yeah.
So, but there's also things I never asked you. It's like, so little Sally Wainwright walking around. What was she like? Did you have like a head full of stories? Because I know you used to write stuff out that people said. But
I think I started becoming aware that I wanted to tell stories when I was about 7. Me and my sister used to do strip cartoons. But I always wanted to be an artist. I always wanted to draw.
Yeah.
And as you did.
Yeah.
You're a great artist.
Well, I've been to your house, and you've like, you've got painting on the furniture, haven't you?
Used to have.
Is it gone now? Yeah.
So it started with me wanting to draw strip cartoons. So it was always a combination of visuals and
what kind of strip cartoons?
Stories.
What was that then?
I can't even remember. It was
about, worth a fortune.
We had these little characters called John and Tim, me and my sister, and they were our teddy bears. It's very sad. Sorry.
It's your juvenilia.
It is my juvenilia.
We'll come to the Brontes later. But
then we started writing plays together, me and my sister.
How old?
Probably 9, 10.
Right.
And then we used to read them together at night. We used to write plays, and then we'd read each other's plays, but we'd read them out loud.
Was it like all-consuming? Was it like in your head?
It was for me. I think Diane did it to humour me, and I think she thought it was very boring. But I used to love it. I just found it really... I always loved dialogue more than... I didn't used to read. I've never been a great... Well, I read novels now, but as a child, I didn't read novels.
Yeah.
I think I was dyslexic. I just couldn't get past the first page. I also thought they were really boring, and it was only the dialogue that excited me. Not just interested me, really excited me. I loved controlling what people said.
Yeah. And that's... And so, when did the first script come out of you? What was the first... Was it play? It was plays.
Well, it was these plays me and Dennis used to write. They were properly scripted.
Brilliant. So then you became... I know you were a student and you were writing and directing plays. So you were directing then. We'll come back to that as well. It's like... I know that a big influence in your career came along in 1977.
Mm.
Everyone thought I, Claudius, was going to win the best drama at the BAFTAs, and it was actually won by Rock Follies, which was a magnificent victory for one of the best programmes ever made. And I know you love that as well. Yeah. It's like, and actually, I know we're going to, I kind of want to go through your life slightly chronologically, but I want to stop off every so often and say, because I think about Rock Follies, I think of how much music you've always put in your stuff, like Virginia singing in the Breakthroughs. Where's your musical, Sally Wainwright?
Where is it?
Where is it?
It's on the way.
Is it? Was it really?
Yeah.
Oh, because you'd be brilliant. Are you really? For stage or for screen? Or?
It's an idea I've got for screen.
Oh, fantastic.
That I'm hoping to
We didn't set that up. I didn't know that.
Yeah.
I tell you what, because I listened to your Desert Island Discs, and I got to be honest, I thought it would be all Bruckner. And it's like, it's hell of a laugh. It's like all your the music you've chosen is like this great big romp through the English countryside with Victoria Woods and a brass band and the St. Trinian's Choir. And that, you literally sit there thinking, write a musical, Sally.
I'd like to, I think it's really hard to get it right.
Yes.
I think it's so easy to get it wrong. For every one that's successful, like Rock Follies, how many more have there been? There's never been another anything resembling
Rock
Follies.
I'm not sure
anyone
tried. I think it kind of...
Because I think people are too scared to commission it.
Well, no, I do.
I don't know.
And, I also think...
Oh, people just don't pitch them because... It is ridiculously hard. It's like talking about dramatising stand-up comedians.
Yeah.
To dramatise a stand-up comedian, which is something I'd love to do, you have to make them very, very funny.
Yeah.
So I can do all the drama.
Yeah.
But then the audience has to believe that this person is genuinely funny. And as with a musical, you have to believe that this is proper good music. Mm. And it's so hard to get
that.
You
are musical, aren't you? You can play... Oh.
It's badly musical.
You can play a piano a bit, can't you?
Really badly, yeah.
Most of us can. That's not bad. So, partly musical. We got that there. Buy shares in that, because that'll just...
I wouldn't be writing the music.
Wouldn't you? I bet you could.
I probably could, but...
There we are. I knew it. So, listen, it's like you were a student, you were writing. Things started to flourish when you got to Granada, really. How did you get into Granada? This was a golden time, I think.
It was wonderful.
Granada, wasn't it?
I got in... 90s. I'd been writing The Archers.
Yes.
And I had... my agent then, Meg Davis, got me in to write a shadow script on families.
Right.
I think...
Yes, because Kay says she read one of your scripts, because one of the great influences and mentors in your career is Kay Mellor. I actually asked Kay about this. She sent me a quote. She said, she charged me money. But she says, today, she says, I can sit and watch Sally's work. I'm not even aware it started life as a script, she said, which is such a great compliment, I think. She also says, I dine out on telling people I found Sally Wainwright. She'd be asking for money next. But what I love about
Granada then at the time, when this was an afternoon soap that Kay invented called Families, and it was brilliant because, you worked on that?
Yeah, a storyline thing.
And what was so wonderful was we sat around the edges, I wasn't a storyline, but I was a wannabe, and we watched the real team having a story conference.
Yeah.
And it was such a privileged thing to see and witness and to learn from. And I learned so much just listening to people like Peter Worley.
Yes, I love Peter, yes.
And, I mean, he was the greatest, but there were a lot of people like him. And just to be able to listen to how they developed an idea.
Yeah.
And how they would riff on an idea and knock it around the room.
I remember when we were doing Revelations and someone at Carlton, as was then, said, I don't think this character is very sympathetic. And Peter Worley said, I don't think sympathetic's high on the list of interesting qualifications. He's right, isn't he? He's absolutely right. And it was because in your time at Granada, it's funny because there will be people out there, there will be students out there and professors writing PhDs about the writing of Sally Wainwright, quite seriously. And there are like 100 episodes of yours stored on the shelves of Granada that no one ever sees. Because obviously you worked on Coronation Street, but I was there, that's where we first met. I was a storyliner. And we made Revelations, we made Spring Hill, we made Castles. You worked on Castles. Does anyone remember Castles?
We wrote things that never got made, like Mario's.
Mario's. We wrote a Coronation Street spin-off called Mario's that never got made. I don't think you knew it was a Coronation Street spin-off. We didn't tell anyone.
No, I didn't know.
No, it was meant to be. and also, tell the world about our best sitcom. Tell the world about our career in sitcom.
This was another Granada venture that me and Russell were... It was a sitcom called House of Windsor, and...
Anyone remember House
really
of Windsor?
Hopefully nobody has ever heard of that, ever.
It was a nightmare.
It was, but we were asked to go. We kind of asked him to rescue it, weren't we? And we didn't.
The person... I don't want to get litigious here. The person who wrote it never turned up.
Yeah.
And it was a sitcom being made in a weekly fashion, like Drop the Dead Donkey. It would be rehearsed all week, recorded on a Friday night, transmitted on a Sunday. So we then had to go into the rehearsal room on a Monday morning with the bad reviews, saying what rubbish it was. And it was rubbish.
It was. I remember Leslie Thomas was in it.
Leslie Phillips.
It was Leslie Thomas.
Leslie Thomas with the Virgin Soldiers.
Oh, right.
He would have written a good script.
Yeah, no, it wasn't him. It was Leslie Phillips. And he was reading this one of my script, and he said to me, "I don't understand what's going on in this script, Sally, do you?" And I said, "Yes, I wrote it." But he didn't.
I had Leslie, well, I loved Leslie Phillips. Leslie Phillips, actually.
I didn't blame him for not reading it properly.
It's the only time I've ever seen an actor do a whole lot of my scripts, look at me, and go like this, throw it away. And you sat there thinking, you're right. In fact, I wrote an episode that went out under a false name. I wrote an episode as Leo Vaughan, which is like a porn star. Leo Vaughan.
And I wish I'd thought to do
that. You know those ALKS forms? They always try to find the payments to pay Leo Vaughan. I've never confessed. It's blood money. It was a great cast, though, wasn't it? It was brilliant.
I can't remember who else was in it.
But did you love... Because what I loved about that time was... It's funny, because you say... You're so modest, and I think you can't see it from our point of view. You'd accept any job going. You're young. Will you work on castles?
Well, you wanted to show that you could do it. You wanted to show that you could do anything they threw at you.
From our point of view, the storylining, a production point of view, we were lucky to have you. We'd be like, oh, Sally says yes. It was. You were like the one in demand. In fact, and we also, of course, worked on Children's Ward, and they were happy days. But I mean, if you ask Paul Abbott, would you advise young writers to go and do a soap opera these days, depending on what mood he's in, he'd say no. If you asked me, I'd say yes, because where were you on that? Would you tell me?
Definitely, I would.
Would you? Yeah.
Well, for the reason I've just said, really, where you are learning so much about how to tell stories.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that's the hardest thing.
Yeah.
That we do. Well, I don't know about you, but for me, story is the hardest single thing about what we do. It's the thing I've really got to work hard at.
Yeah.
And it was working on a soap that made me realise that you've got to work at it.
Yeah.
You've really got to throw yourself into it and sit there until things start to... It's not going to just happen without you actually actively...
Yeah. It made me realise there's no end to them. That's what I took away from soap operas, which is that you do a great story about Fred, and then that comes to an end, and now you've got to think of another one.
Mm.
And you can. It's like a muscle getting exercised, isn't it? Actually, there are more stories to come. So I loved it. It's like, I remember writing, in Children's Ward, writing a jilting at the altar, Sister Mitchell, Judy Holt, at the altar. I think it's one of the most powerful things I've ever written, because it's horrific what she went through at that. So I loved it. I'm glad you look back happily on that. And it's like someone should dig those things out of the shelves. So then, what we're moving on to then now is that your first... You were quiet... Hold on a minute. You were quiet then. Were you... We'd sit through meetings with, you'd have storyline commissioning conferences, and Sally wouldn't say a word. And if you did, we were terrified. We'd all go, oh my God. If you sat there and went, I don't agree with this bit, the entire storyline team go, oh my God, we got it wrong, like that. So you probably never knew how powerful you were in your silence. You were.
No, I wasn't powerful at all.
You were to us. You didn't know that.
I was just terrified.
Yeah. Were you? But like,
yeah. No, I was. I was terrified. I couldn't. I know it was weird that I didn't speak. And I'm ashamed of it.
No, well, that's funny, because it had enormous power.
And then,
power.
Of course, the more it goes on, the more you can't speak, because when you do, it's like, fucking hell, that's weird, she spoke.
I was thinking it's different, because there was Coronation Street.
And Coronation Street was particularly hard for that, because it was this room full of people who'd been there a long, long time, who really knew what they were doing, who'd made that show into the legend that it was.
Yeah.
And they were just so clever, and I just thought, I can't...
They were also, they were powerful men.
They were
brilliant writers. How was that as a woman going into, well, it was a very masculine world, although very often with female producers. Was it tough?
I found it very overwhelming.
Yeah.
And they could be quite cruel as well
whenever
it was, early 90s.
It was.
I mean, it was still a kind of culture where at lunchtime everybody would just drink a lot.
Yeah.
And then the afternoon would be like Armageddon.
Yeah.
It would be a bloodbath. So I kept my head under the parapet. I was just scared. I wasn't powerful.
Really? Yeah. They were. It was a scare. I only dipped in. I storylined a few blocks, and I was terrified of those people. Absolutely terrified. They were enormously powerful.
And they were just unwieldy meetings. They're like 20 people around a table.
Yeah.
So unless you have got something very definite and very clear to say, I would find that very difficult.
Yeah. And it's also...
I wouldn't now.
No. No, but they were also enormously wise. I went to just a few of those storytelling sessions, and I can remember things to this day. I'm writing the script, and I think, oh, remember what John Stevenson said about characters and things like that. So it was a great learning place. Mm. So how did you...
And they were, I mean, they'd been, some of those writers had been there 30 years, so they really knew what they were talking about. Why bother speaking? Just sit there and learn.
Yeah, that's true. And I think you did well. You picked up some good stuff. So listen, you're on a soap opera then. Oh. And like, if you're a soap opera writer, the holy grail is to get your own show. How did you go from being on a Coronation Street team to getting your own show?
I think I was lucky. Luck and hard work, which is the usual thing. I mean, I'd been writing The Braithwaites for about 15 years before it got commissioned. I mean, it was a story...
15 years?
Yeah, I mean, it was a story I'd had in my head for... about 15 years before...
Were they pools winners originally? That's before the lottery?
No, originally she... it wasn't to do with money originally, it was to do with a family. A story about a family, and it became... Wow. What it became further on. At one point she was going to get 38 million from... British Telecom had accidentally credited her account with £38 million. And she tried to ring them up to tell them they'd made a mistake, but of course she couldn't get through to anyone. So she didn't bother.
That's a commission, by the way. I love that.
It's something that I'd been working on, this dysfunctional... I didn't realise they were dysfunctional. It was just about my family, you know? This dysfunctional...
I left my phone on. Excuse me.
You're answering.
I'm just turning it off. Yeah, turning off. Get me out of
here. Carry on. I'd been working on it for quite a long time before it actually got...
Who did you take it to? What got it made?
I think Tony Wood originally commissioned it as a half-hour sitcom.
Did he?
Yeah. And he said, write the third episode. Write the first one. Write the third episode. And that was a brilliant piece of advice, because it became the first episode, but it hit the ground running. And then I think Caroline Reynolds took it over, and she decided she wanted it as an hour-long drama.
Yeah.
And then we went to Nick Elliott at ITV, who didn't like it.
Oh, right.
But I think David Liddiman leaned on him and told him to commission it.
He
did.
But you talk about all these people who are champions for both of us, David Liddiman, Caroline Reynolds, Tony Wood, all these people become lists of your career. Thank God for them all.
But, like so many shows, like Last Tango, like Scott and Bailey, very nearly didn't ever get made.
Yes. So, Nicola Schindler said that four people turned down Last Tango, got turned down four times.
Mm. We thought it had finished, we thought it had gone.
Wow.
And then Danny Cohen came to BBC One, and the World of BBC, and...
Brilliant. It's
commissioned
brilliant.
It overnight.
And then, because that was like... That was a big success, The Breakers. I loved it. And what was that? What was success like? The thing we're never allowed to talk about, being successful. It's not. It's like, because we're British, we're not supposed to even acknowledge it. How was it?
I thought it was normal.
Yeah.
So when I had the next show I did was Sparkhouse, and it like died a death. I was really shocked.
Because it was still good, though. It was a great show.
Thought it was great, but I was lucky with The Braithwaites that it did do so well, but I just thought that was what happened.
Oh, that's interesting. Because round about this time, round about when you kind of like...
Naively.
When you're round about this age, it's like, you married Austin, you've got two kids. It's like, did you start, and this is a very vague question, but it's like, speak as a childless man, do you start to see television through your children's eyes and how they watch it? Does that affect you?
Yes.
Has that affected you?
Massively. I don't know if you've become aware of this, but the older I get, your gender alters. And I've found that my protagonists tend to be the same age as me, and they get older as I do. So I'm writing, like what I'm writing now, it's about 50-odd-year-old women. Yeah. Whereas when I was writing The Braithwaites, I was writing basically about... I was more in tune with like Virginia than I was with Alison, because I thought Alison was old because she was 40.
It's funny, Kay Mellor, when we worked on Children's World, Kay Mellor used to say that. I used to produce it, you used to write it, and she used to say, beware, because you will always cast parents as your own age. And as you get older, and you've got to remember that people are having kids at 18. Don't cast them too old. Words of wisdom from that woman, always. Yeah.
But the thing that affects me most, watching something like that we've just watched from The Braithwaites, it makes me cringe, because I think having children, I worry about how much, you know, bad language I use. I do use a lot of bad language.
Do you really?
And
I
think I didn't used to care, and now I do notice it.
Oh, do you?
But I still do it anyway.
I know, I think you use it really carefully and sparingly.
I think, I think having children as well has made me a bit more responsible. I think I write about more grown-up things now than I used to.
Yeah.
I mean, the Braithwaites was just a laugh.
Oh, it was more than just a laugh. It was much more rich than that. That was a proper family. I loved them. Would you ever bring them back?
Bring them back?
Yeah. No one. Left.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah. Well, there we go. The sound of Kevin Ligo breaking the speed barrier there. I sign this.
I think it might be quite interesting, but it's one of those where it's probably a mistake.
Or just start it again. Maybe you should do like Kay does with the Syndicate and in the Cloud, just a new family. Because maybe they were so complicated by the other Braithwaites. That was also the first time, because you weren't writing, did it end on series 4? You weren't writing them all.
I wrote the first two episodes of series 4.
Right.
And then I went off.
Because you've done that twice. You've done that on the Braithwaites, done that on Scott and Bailey. What's that like, working in a team, working with other people? Are you happy with that?
No, I found it really hard. The only time it really, really worked was with Amelia Bulmore on Scott and Bailey.
Of course.
Her episodes were just sublime.
Yeah,
they were
brilliant.
And I never...
And she ended up taking over the show, didn't she?
Yeah. And, you know, as you know, when you have other people writing on your shows, it just doesn't work. Or it's really hard work, or it's difficult, or it's
hard, isn't it?
You know, if you have to rewrite your scripts, it's unpleasant.
Yes.
For them and for you.
Yeah.
And the amazing thing about Amelia was I just didn't touch them.
Goldust.
Didn't have to and didn't want to, and they were wonderful, absolutely wonderful.
Hooray for the
So it's very rare, but not, yeah.
Yeah. Would you do that again, or is it something you'd avoid now? It's
working with other people.
Yeah. I'm not asking you to. I love your scripts. There you are.
I would with Amelia.
Would you?
Yeah. Definitely. Brilliant. Yeah. Brilliant. But yes, it's risky, because we know how much every writer puts into something.
So then
for us to come along and say, actually, I'm going to rewrite 90% of it.
I think you find that
it's
with
not
a lot
good
of,
for anyone, is it?
You find it with a lot of young, new writers. It's what John Cleese said about when he was at the height of his pomp, of his powers with Fawlty Towers. And he's speaking about other comedy writers. He said, they do not know what hard work it is. And it is, isn't it? Mm-hmm. It's properly everything. It's the hours are just beyond description. Anyway, post-Braithwaite, I think you had a really, really fascinating period then where there were kind of like a few dramas in a row. There was Mrs. Pritchard, the amazing Mrs. Pritchard, you saw a clip of, Jane Hall and Bonkers. Mm-hmm. And it was kind of like, I loved all those three, I loved them. And it did. I thought Bonkers was truly Bonkers. I loved it. But it was kind of like, I would say you were kind of questing for your next big idea. Like, did it feel like that? Did it feel like you were reaching for...
I think with Bonkers, I was trying to make another Braithwaite. I think I wanted to try and capture a similar audience and create something with a similar feel to it.
Yeah.
And it just didn't work. It really didn't work. People just didn't get what was going on.
It did work, but it was...
It had a tiny audience. It got really slagged off by the critics.
Did it? Yeah, but it worked, I think.
I was more obsessed about Mrs. Pritchard because that didn't get good reviews and it got a slightly better audience, but I was really proud of that. Mm. I couldn't have worked harder than I did.
Is that hard when things aren't working?
I found it hard with that because I worked so hard on that show. I think probably harder than anything I've ever worked on. Just because there's so much research involved.
Yeah.
Huge amount of research. And I was so proud of
Mrs.
Jane
Pritchard,
Hollis.
For people who might not have seen it, it was about a woman who becomes the Prime Minister.
Mm.
It was Borgen before Borgen. And I much prefer Mrs. Pritchard was better than Borgen by a million miles, I think. And it's funny, because then round about this time when Bonkers came out, you hit a very difficult patch in your life and in your career, which is that Bonkers... I'll be careful not to go into too much detail, but Bonkers, you were accused of plagiarism.
Yes.
Properly, legally faced with a claim of plagiarism. I won't even give that oxygen, because it's clearly you're short of ideas. And I did see you backstage going through my bag. And if you go around this festival pitching a cartoon about a gay duck, that's fucking fine. Okay? Dandy the duck. That's
More from Sally and Russell in just a moment, but let's hear a little clip first of this week's Media Masters with Paul Blanchard. This is the broadcaster and interviewer Matthew Stadlin. You may remember he used to do those brilliant 5 minutes with interviews on the BBC News channel. Here's Matthew.
And I had a conversation once with one of the commissioning editors of the Telegraph. She said, look, I want to know, I want more of Matt in there. I want to know, what does Matt Stadlin think about that person? And I found that quite challenging. And I sometimes found it challenging because if you have had a very intimate conversation with someone for an hour and a half, perhaps even longer, and you broadly speaking get on with them, and anyway they're a human being, then to step out of that room when you've had a very enjoyable experience and be directly critical of them or impose a negative view on them, I found quite tricky.
That was Matthew Stadland there, and you can hear all of Paul's brilliant Media Masters interviews for free at mediamasters.fm, or you can subscribe to the Media Focus podcast wherever you get your podcasts.
Small details or big surfaces, tight corners or odd shapes, flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Because literally, if you list your credits, the next drama coming along is Unforgiven.
Yeah.
Which even in that 10-second clip there, when Suran Jones stands on that wall and says, "I used to live there," what a powerful drama.
Yeah. That did literally come out of what I went through then, because it did make me think, what is it like to be on the wrong side of the law?
Yeah.
Which, weirdly, I found myself on the wrong side of the law. And I had no idea that somebody can sue anybody for anything.
Yeah.
Absolutely anything. And if you find yourself having to defend yourself, you have to defend yourself. You can't just think, well, I don't care, I'm not going
to. You kind of have to prove your innocence, don't you?
Yeah.
Which is ridiculous.
And of course, it never went to court because.
No.
It was completely groundless.
Nothing to go to court. But weirdly.
But it did have.
It led to that.
It put me. And as I say, I think my work has got darker since then. I think prior to that happening to me, it was. I felt I was chiefly a comedy writer. Right. Not a sitcom writer, but somebody who wrote comedy. And I think
that's weird, isn't it? Because I'm kind of glad it happened.
After that, I am now. I've made a lot of money out of it, thanks, Tricia.
Because also, I think
probably sue me now for that. Probably want half, more.
To me, when you look at Unforgiven, it's not the first time, because it was starting in Sparkhouse, but it's the first time you went from like a big cast, like a gang show, to focusing on one person. Because that was really Suran Jones' story.
Mm.
And was that deliberate? Was that you saying, I'm going to write differently now?
No, I mean, I don't think it was about one person. It was always about the structure of Unforgiven, I thought, was what was exciting, was that it was about three different groups of people.
Right.
Or four, I can't remember. But it was about four separate groups of people.
Parents,
and it was about how they all came together at the end, how you realised by the end of episode one that they weren't four separate groups.
Yeah.
They were all very interconnected. And Ruth was just sort of at the centre of all that.
But coming out of the bonkers nonsense, did it feel good writing it? Did it feel you felt yourself going somewhere new?
Yes. I mean, I did consciously make that connection, because I did think about what is it like to be on the wrong side of the law.
Brilliant.
I don't know.
Because it's like, I'm going to go off on a diversion now, which is that one of the things you should be writing a musical. Here's your next thing. It's because it's what I loved in Unforgiven. I love Siobhan Finner and thought there was a ghost. Nicola Shinders mentioned to me that this Last Tango in Halifax coming up at Christmas has kind of. I'm fascinated by you and the supernatural, because I think it's knocking at the edges of your work. I know you wrote The Last Witch, and because I think you're a you're fabulously focused on the real world. Everything has to be real with you. Every line of dialogue has to be real with you. You've said that a million times, and it's there in your writing. And in this sense, I think you're like Dickens, and I mean that as in the highest compliment. I really think you're like Dickens. We've got these brilliant, huge, vivid characters, these big, epic stories, these intimate stories. And like Dickens, you've got the supernatural clawing at the window.
But I remember, I got that from you, that idea that you can put this tiny little bits of otherworldliness in. It was on that series of Children's Ward.
It was
about the boy who got the transplant.
He got a heart transplant.
And the boy
Stephen Arnold was then on Coronation Street, yeah.
The boy who died, whose heart he got appeared at the end of his bed, and I had a conversation with him.
We did.
And I remember talking about that, and me saying, you can't do that, because this is a serious, straightforward drama, and you said, no, it's great.
Oh, my God, yeah. It was
that's always stayed with me.
And I never knew that.
Think, yes, you can put these strange little bits of...
Yeah. Just because...
You know,
because
just that notion that there's more between heaven and earth than...
Yes, because it's such a contrast with your absolute realism. And the thing is, when Dickens did... Because Dickens would write about the dispossessed and the poor. He was the only person writing about the poor and the wretched. And when he then wrote a ghost story, he wrote a ghost story that was so good, it is replacing the Bible as the Christmas story. It's like, literally, Christmas Carol is becoming... Christmas Carol started time travel and parallel worlds and the ability to change your future. It's one of the most powerful things I've ever written. Where's your ghost story? Come on.
I want to write a ghost story. I'd love to do a really proper ghost story.
Really? I knew I write, yes.
But I don't know what it is yet.
Because Caroline is a
haunt. Just had an idea.
But Caroline is... My idea! I'm claiming 10%. Right now. If it's a musical and a ghost, you're going to do the amazing Mr. Blunden, aren't you? Let's face it. But it's, you know, Caroline's haunted by the past in Last Tango. Catherine's haunted by a dead daughter. It's literally steeped in your work. The ghosts are at the edge. Go on.
Catherine, which one? One of them. Catherine
Caroline, one of those. Yeah. Sarah Lancashire.
That's not haunting. That's panic attacks.
No, but it's testing the picture. It's testing her mind. Yeah. I know it's not. It's real. But it's like, I'd love to see you head that way. Go on. And also, now we're hitting, I think, one of the great... I hope they're all here. I hope Charlotte Moore people are here like this, because one of the great unmade pieces of television, because we're kind of hitting like around about 2009 and stuff like that, you were lined up to take over Robin Hood.
That's right, yeah.
And you also... Didn't you also want to do a Saturday Night series about a highway woman?
Yes.
You
Ballad
see?
Of Black Nell.
What's it called?
The Ballad of Black Nell.
The Ballad of Black Nell? Unmade television.
Yeah.
How mad is television? How much do we want to see these series? It's because especially with those Saturday night fantasy shows, they're still rolling out now, and they're still all about men.
Yep.
All of them. Every single one. And would you have done a female Robin Hood? Is that right?
That was the idea, yeah. That Robin Hood was going to become a kind of token bloke who wasn't very bright. And the power behind him was this... I think she was called Ruth. They're all based on real characters from
brilliant. You wrote scripts first, didn't you?
I wrote about 4 episodes. And me and Sian Ellery Jones from BBC Wales wrote 2 series of 13 episodes, storylines.
Storylines.
Yeah.
Commission? Where are they? Where are you all? Don't you want to see that? I want to see that.
Yeah.
That's not... Is it dead? Would you still do that?
Yeah. Yeah.
You see... So you did that for Robin Hood?
Well, I think I would. I mean,
when
things don't happen, you're probably the same. You probably think, well, there's a reason.
Move on, I know.
And they come back.
I do think
And maybe
come
they
back.
Come back at the right time.
Yeah.
And maybe
it
wasn't the right time when these things...
Yeah.
I mean, if it had gone on, I'd never written Scott and Bailey. I probably wouldn't have written Last Tango.
Because when it comes back, I'd love to see it. I'm just saying that. I put in my pitch in all these shows that are yet to exist. It's like... So that you did. I read an interview where you sort of said how much, because next you went on to Scott and Bailey, and you said how much you love discovering crime and what a story engine crime is. And you know, indeed, we've got Happy Valley since. I wish I could discover that. I can't get on with it. I can't do it.
Well, I prided myself for a certain time on never having written a cop drama.
Yeah.
But then I was lucky that I met Diane Taylor, who was the consultant on Scott and Bailey, and I met her socially. I didn't meet her with an eye to writing a cop drama.
No.
It was just coincidental that Saran wanted to, you know, she invented Scott and Bailey, and then her and Nicola came to me to ask me to do it. And I had coincidentally met Diane Taylor.
Right. just an inspiration, yeah.
You know, completely coincidental.
Well, Scott Bailey kind of led to Happy Valley in a way. It's,
yes, it did, very much so. Yeah, yeah. But it was talking to Diane, who is a detective. She was a detective, she's retired now, but she was a detective inspector with Greater Manchester MIT. She did deal with murders all the time.
Yeah.
And it was just so fascinating talking to her because I thought, I've never seen that on telly. We have all these cop dramas and they have never seen what she's talking about on telly.
Yeah.
So many of our police procedurals are based on American models.
Yeah.
And our system is just so different.
Because what I think you got was that you got how mad and clumsy and stupid crime is.
Yeah.
My favourite moments are like Rachel and Janet rolling their eyes. They were constantly shrugging at every stupid thug who came through the door. And I think there were bits of that in Cracker. I think Jimmy used to do a bit of that in Cracker. But I think this was a much more kind of much more ordinary dimension. They were still magnificent criminals in Cracker.
Yeah.
And you just got the plainness of it. And
well, I remember one of the first conversations I had with Diane, we were talking about the Moors murderers. Mm. And I was doing some research about Myra Hindley at the time. And I wanted to ask her what made somebody capable of doing things like that. What had they got that made them capable of doing that? Mm. And she had this fantastic answer with that it isn't what they've got, it's what they haven't got.
Wow.
It's there's something in their brain that doesn't tell them that you shouldn't really be doing that.
Wow.
I suspect it's a, conscience.
Yeah,
but,
absolutely.
But the point was that people who do things like that predominantly are.
Where's your Myra Hindley drama then?
People who have
that's
bits
another
missing.
One.
It got too dark. I eventually.
Yeah, I bet.
Put all that research in the bin. I couldn't.
Not the one
it.
To make a musical, maybe. I think. Just
possibly not.
Someone laughed.
Somebody did make a musical about that once, didn't
it? It's like. Because I loved that it went Scott and Bailey went to
skull,
I know skull. It's like, that's Kate the dead lesbian on her way coming to face you. You're not getting away with that one. Yeah. Because what there's this roster now we're getting with Suran Jones and Leslie Sharp and Amanda Redmond, Sarah Smart. It's like the women you will work with just are they queuing up at your door? Do you get Frances de la Tour doing your gardening? Can they just drop a script
it's
off
funny
with
you? Should mention that.
They're all dying to get in there. But it's like, your men, would you write a series with a man as a lead character?
Yes.
Good. Do it then. Because what I love about your men is that, seriously, I love David Braithwaite.
Yeah.
I love.
I've just, the Last Tango Christmas special I've just finished writing, there's a big story with Gillian and Robbie.
Oh.
And Robbie's quite big in it. And
oh, brilliant.
I was very conscious of thinking that I'm writing a really good part and it's about a man, it's about a man's story.
Your men are brilliant because it's often said you're a very strong woman, as if I can't even bear that phrase. And then people say you're like weak men. Your men are fabulous. It's like if you took Kevin, from that last series of Happy Valley, if you took Kevin Doyle, if you remove the fact he murdered someone, just think of the murder, to see a detective like that weak and shagging and lying but trying his best, I'd love to see that. I don't watch detective shows because I can't bear the detectives, but your men, I would watch that show. I think it'd be brilliant. So a musical with ghosts and
some men in it.
With some men in it. It would be brilliant. Last Tango comes along, which is brilliant. This is kind of like, we have to do so much in an hour. I could talk forever about Last Tango. Very famously based on a true experience of your mum.
Yeah.
Amazing. Yeah. She actually got together with a childhood sweetheart.
Yeah.
Did she charge money for that? She's saying, you owe me money for this. But it's like, that was such a success. It kind of hits a little period of your career where a bit of controversy came along. Kate got killed off in series three. And for the first time I saw you sort of getting some flack. I know you'd also got a lot of flack for Happy Valley, for the violence in there. How was that for the first time being attacked? You were quite vociferously attacked.
It was a shock. I didn't realise how attached the audience had become to that relationship and to those two characters.
It's a death in Last Tango on Halifax where Sarah Lancashire's girlfriend is killed.
Yeah.
It was tough. You know, it was tough to watch. It might be one of my least favourite things you ever wrote, partly because it was off stage.
Yeah.
And I know, I kind of think you were trying to make a point that death is random and off stage, but it kind of had an effect of it being an off stage death. And I know, I think it's really unfortunate. I think you walked slightly into a world where, of those lesbian deaths, which have extraordinary numbers, I know Jackie Lawrence has done compiled statistics of there being of lesbian characters being killed off. What people miss is that Caroline is alive at the heart of the drama, and she's a lesbian as well. But it's tough, isn't it, when you get that flack?
I found it hard, and I regretted it. I think I did make a mistake.
Did you?
I wish I'd found a better story.
Do you know what I wish?
But it was, you know, it was a good story. It was a good story. Yeah. And obviously been criticised by the same people for saying this, but, you know, the main characters, it was a fantastic story for Caroline and Celia.
Yeah.
And,
do you know, I could have told you were going to have that flack. Nicola told me you were doing that story, and I went, oh, I literally went...
What wish you had?
I know. Well, you don't, it's not, you don't feel, you know, you're in the office, like, chatting, going, what's happening in Last Tango Next Year? Oh, Kate's going to get killed. And I literally, because I know the gays quite well, I literally went, oh, my God, that's going to be trouble. I did, and I'm kicking myself for... Yeah. Would you have listened to me though if I'd said you're going to get in trouble with that?
Yeah, because I was like on the cusp of thinking I'm not sure this is the right thing to do, and other people were, you know, it was a good story, it was good drama.
I cried my eyes out at the same time. It was a brilliant funeral and all that. It's hard.
But you do worry afterwards that you've been a bit, you could have worked harder, you would, you know, it was a lazy choice. All the criticisms. Yeah. No, those are the criticisms.
Oh, right.
So then you think, was I being lazy?
No, I think it was kind of unfortunate. I still loved it. It's still a great drama out of it. We're moving on now. This juggernaut is heading towards us. And literally, Sally, in my life is strung together of great dramas. And this started with Rock Follies and Pennies from Heaven and I, Claudius, and then Cracker and Prime Suspect, and then The Braithwaite, and then there was Happy Valley. I'm glad to be alive during the transmission of Happy Valley. I love it that much. You would not have torn me from the television. Everyone is sitting there thinking, and it's my duty to ask, what news on Series 3? Is it
happening? Happy Valley?
Yes.
It will happen.
Right.
But it'll be a little while.
Good,
before
take your time.
We get
is it cooking? Do you, is it?
Yeah, I've got some good ideas.
Wow.
Can I just say I feel exactly the same way about Queer as Folk? That was, for me, that was one of the most...
Oh, let's talk about me.
Extraordinary.
Come on. Oh, thank you. They were good days, weren't they?
TV shows.
Oh,
ever.
Happy days.
It was just so vibrant. And it was like Rock Follies. Like, I felt that same feeling that I felt as a 13-year-old watching Rock Follies. It was like this tangible excitement.
Brilliant. That's the best compliment in the world. Thank you. It all comes out of that Granada...
Yeah.
Furnace, doesn't it? Of all of us, like I say, Tony Wood, finding all of us writers, and Dan McVerry, all those people in there. In Happy Valley, you started directing, which you'd always wanted to do, and you'd never had the confidence to do. Was it? Why did you? I haven't got the confidence to do it. I'd love to do it.
No, you should.
I know. It's the thought of turning up in the morning and there were 60 sweaty arse riggers asking you what to do, because I get enough of that in my social life. I didn't prepare that one at all. But seriously, actually, turning up and facing all those people, 9 a.m, off you go. Christ, I find that terrifying. How are, you love it though, don't you?
I do love it. They're not waiting for you to tell them what to do. They're just getting on with it.
I know.
I mean, that's what struck me. One of the many things that struck me is that when you're in there, everybody knows what they're doing.
Yeah.
And
that's nice.
It's such a big team effort, and it's delightful. It's really exciting.
You love it, don't you?
Yeah.
Always,
like
always
nothing else.
Do.
I love it more than writing.
Do you?
And it's and I love writing.
Wow, you love it more than writing?
I think so. I think
that's
inspiring. It's harder. It's not harder. It's hard in a different way.
Listen, I'm timing this badly. Next, finally, you've done you've got a Bronte, a drama about the Brontes coming up, To Walk Invisible. What is it? Is it their lives? Is it a day in the life?
Well, I was asked to write a biopic about the Brontes because it's Charlotte Bronte's bicentenary of her birth this year.
Right.
And I think about 5 years ago, the BBC asked me to do this, and I didn't get around to doing it because of lots of other stuff. But so finally did before we ran out of time for 2016. So they asked for a biopic. So I've looked at the last 3 years when they were all still alive, they'd all been away doing different things, but they were all back at home in 1845 various dysfunctional reasons. I mean, they were like the archetypal dysfunctional family in many ways, the Brontes. So it's looking at that last 3 years. So it's about their whole lives, but it's concentrating in those last 3 years. Extraordinarily eventful. I didn't have to invent anything,
really.
In terms of the structure, it was all there.
Brilliant. Emily Bronte.
Big stroppy woman.
So that's come up at Christmas. Listen, I have loved sitting here and doing this, and we could talk for 50 more hours. We should do Q&As from the floor. So are you going to turn the lights up? And has anyone got a question for Dame Sally Wainwright? Anybody out there?
You were talking a lot about picking up things from being in writers' rooms at soaps and watching other writers talking to other writers, producers. I was just wondering if you can even say, what's the best piece of advice you've ever been given?
Well, one of the best pieces of advice is the one I mentioned that Tony Wood gave me about don't ever write the first episode of a new series, write the third episode, because you'll hit the ground running. You'll come into where the action is. You'll come into where the story is. Another thing I remember Paul Abbott once telling me that really struck me when we were writing Children's Ward. He rang me up and he said he was very pleased with the script, and he says, it's obvious that you've not written the first thing that's come into your head, or the second thing, or the third thing. He says, you've written the seventh thing that's come into your head, which is true. You know, you do. I think that's a really good piece of advice, is you have to think really hard about the perfect way of saying something.
I remember Paul Abbott on Children's Ward saying, psychology is simple. Actually, they're jealous or they're angry. I've always remember that, writing the script. It's like, psychology is simple. Any more questions? Anybody?
Hello. As a writer, I would really like to teach myself a bit more about directing. What advice would you give someone who's wanting to be self-taught rather than, you know, going off to do an MA in directing at 24?
I think you've just got to do it. You've just got to get on with it. You've got to get yourself into a situation where you can just start making mistakes. I mean, what I did when I was at university was start directing plays there. You know, I would find people anywhere who were interested in drama and direct them. You know, just find opportunities for yourself. You've just got to do it. I think the only way to learn to direct is to actually do it. It's like writing. Nobody can really teach it you. You've just got to do it.
Because you had a fight to be on set more when you were starting on, like, the Braithwaites and stuff like that. Because that's how you learned to do it, was being on set.
I think the culture was different then. I think there was a culture then of the writer being excluded or...
Were you thrown off set with the Braithwaites?
Thrown off the set?
Weren't you? Or not thrown off? Oh, right.
No, I don't think I was.
I'll remind you about that later off stage.
I may have blanked it out. Was I?
I'll tell you that later. You have forgotten. Brilliant. Anyway, but I think the problem there is that how do you get to be on set? How do you get to do that? It's.
Well, I think the culture's changed. I think writers are more. Well, and like you, I work with execs like Nicola who actively encourage the writer to be much more involved.
We haven't mentioned Nicola Shimper,
But I think then there was more of a culture of the writers don't get their job and they can fuck off now and we'll have a laugh producing
it. Would you ever direct someone else's script?
Well, I have done. I've directed plays, stage plays.
Right, yeah.
I think with telly...
That's what I mean.
Yeah, I was. If it was, but I'd be very picky about it.
So My Gay Duck.
Yeah,
could
I'll
be
do that.
That'd be brilliant, hadn't it? Does that any help? Hooray, thank you. There's a question over there as well.
We talked very interestingly about your past and some of your kind of things you're working on at the moment, but taking kind of longer term view, what do you think about the future of television? Will writers like you and young writers coming up have the same creative freedoms? Are you optimistic about the future of television in this country and say globally as well?
I do worry that there aren't as many opportunities as we had, like when we were at Granada. I think we were in a very privileged place that I've never quite experienced before. Is there anything like that around?
No, it's. Do you know what? Someone said to me recently, actually, that they'd be very cheeky. They sort of said ITV has actually trained a lot of Britain's writers. It's you, it's me, it's Paul Abbott, it's Kay, it's even Mike Bartlett had his first thing ITV. They said that ITV trains them and then the BBC steals them. Very interesting. That person was Kevin Ligo. Said that. But it's kind of got a point to it. It's like, it's. I think there's always opportunities, though, aren't there?
I don't know.
It's hard, isn't it? Yeah. Do you help? You know, I was enormously mentored by Paul Abbott, and you were enormously mentored by Kay. We were very lucky; they kind of seized upon us. Do you try and pay that back? Do you?
I do whatever I can. People do ask me to mentor. That I've done. I had a couple of students who were doing like MAs at De Montfort.
Yeah.
But I think that's very different to what it was like with like Paul and Kay, because we were there doing the job.
Yes.
We met each other in meetings. It was an organic process.
And they had programmes they could actually get us onto. Yeah.
Were kind to us because they were there and they responded to what we were doing. And it was. Whereas now people on writing courses, I find that hard. That you know you meet them once a every 6 months in a coffee shop, and it's hard to impart. Well, you do what you can, but it doesn't feel. I don't feel like I've ever been able to do for someone else what Kerr did for me.
No, it's hard.
It's just not arisen that it's been a part of an organic process.
I agree.
But I wish I could. I'd love to.
Yeah, you will. Of course you will. Anyone else with the questions? One there.
I'm just wondering, you were saying about the lack of opportunity though. What do you think of the American writer room system? What do you think about that as like a training ground almost to help people get experience writing first drafts at least?
I don't really know how it works. I've never been party to the American. It sounds great. I don't know that we could ever do it in this country, though. I don't know if we could afford to do things like that.
Well, it's funny, because we're talking about the American Writers' Room system. For 60 years, the number one programme in British television has been Coronation Street, which is run by a team of writers.
Yeah.
It just doesn't get included in the conversation, so actually it does exist in this country. Mm. It might not be the type of drama you like or you want, but a lot of people want it, so it does exist, and it exists very successfully. That's how you started. That's where you began, so it does work. I promised a question to that person at the back there.
What's your favourite sitcom, and what type of sitcoms do you like?
My favourite sitcom is... I loved Pulling. I thought that was fantastic. I like Nurse Jackie, probably. Is that a sitcom? I think it's funny. I would say Nurse Jackie's probably... Is it a sitcom, Nurse Jackie?
Go on, whatever you want it to be.
Yeah.
Your session.
I would say that, yeah.
Thanks.
It's it's very dark. I think that's why I like it. It's to me on that level that it's very dark and very funny.
Brilliant show. Couple more questions. There was the man over there, and then we'll do that person there, and then we'll have to end it, I think.
Location, you're very good at capturing a certain part of Britain. Hmm. Have you ever written things that are located somewhere else than the north? Do you think you could handle writing about an international location or something like that as easily?
Yeah, I think location isn't really the issue, but I do think it's important. I think wherever you choose to set something, if you can make it part of the fabric of the show, so it's not... I hate, like, generic, you know, America or generic the south of England. I think if you can make it very specifically rooted in very... particular part of the world, it adds to the realism, it adds to the authenticity. But I hope one could write something like that anyway.
And then there was a question over there.
Hi, you've talked a lot about kind of shuttling between genres and territories, like you went from kind of situational dramas to then you were avoiding cop dramas and then you went into that. Is there a territory that you're scared of but you think you haven't depicted yet that you want to throw yourself into?
Well, this musical thing sounds quite exciting.
Yeah. Okay.
I'm quite scared of that, but I'll do that next.
Brilliant. Absolutely. I can't wait for that show. Listen, so we have to wrap up now. I'd like to say thank you to Sally for being so magnificent. To end it, I asked Nicola Schindler, who we barely mentioned, who was a huge part of our lives as a producer, I said, what's the best thing about working with Sally Wainwright? And she said, to be any help to her, you've got to be at the top of your game with her. She makes me work better and harder because she is the best. I then asked Nicola Schindler, what's the worst thing about working with Sally? She said, to be any help, you've got to be at the top of the game with her. She makes me work better and harder because she's the best. She's literally said, it's the best, and she adores you. And everyone adores your work. I literally think you're the finest writer in the land. Thank you for doing
this. Thank you
everyone.
Very much.
Well, that's it from this bonus edition of the programme. Thanks again to the TV Festival for sharing this session with the Media Podcast. If you're wondering where to go next, may we again recommend Media Masters, this week with Matthew Stadlin. That's at mediamasters.fm. I'm Ollie Mann, the producer is Matt Hill, and the Media Podcast is a PPM production. Until next time, bye-bye.
Small details or big surfaces, tight corners or odd shapes, flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves
without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.